Hello, 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 podcast listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Journey to Midwifery podcast. Today's guest is Katie Page, who at the time of this recording is the president of the Virginia chapter of ACNM. She shares her journey to midwifery as well as a fun lesson in government on how bills are made and how to make changes in your state to midwifery practice. I hope you will enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed interviewing Katie. Welcome to the Journey to Midwifery podcast. This podcast platform is for midwives to tell their story. This is where you get to hear the how and the why a person is called on this journey to midwifery. I'm your host, Amber Wilson, a midwife myself, and I came up with this idea so that all those people asking these questions had a place to go to find answers. I hope you enjoy these stories as much as I enjoy recording them. Okay, hello, Katie. Thank you for coming on. I am really excited to share your story and all the great things happening in the state of Virginia with you today. So tell us who you are first.
Okay, great. I'm so excited to be here and really honored for the invitation. I am in Lynchburg, Virginia. I have been in practice here since 2013. I've been a midwife since 2010. And I, in my professional organization capacity, I am the president of the Virginia affiliate of ACNM. And I also currently serve as the chair of the professional liability committee for the national organization.
And also you're a mama and a wife, as we saw.
And I'm a mom and
so you're busy. And your plate is full.
And all the things. Yes.
Yeah. 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 So we will start with the really exciting news that you heard yesterday for Virginia.
So in Virginia, we just had some really exciting movement. We've been working on legislation this year in the Virginia General Assembly, which is House Bill 1817, which would grant full practice authority for certified nurse midwives. And we were successful yesterday in getting through the Senate, which was our last milestone before the bill advances to the governor. So it is now headed its way to Governor Northam's desk, and we are working on the next phase of advocacy to ask the governor to sign the bill. And yesterday was actually, this whole process has been super interesting, and I know we'll get more granular, but in the House, the bill passed. We can talk all the steps that this particular bill went through, but in its second vote in the House, it passed 89-0. And then when it came back to the floor of the Senate yesterday, it passed 20-18. And then by the end of the day, there were some decisions by some policymakers, by some representatives to recall the vote, which means they wanted to vote on it again. They didn't like the result, so they wanted to vote on it again. And we won again.
Oh.
20-19.
Nice. Oh, that's close.
So we flipped some votes, they flipped some votes, and we still came out successful. And now it advances to the governor. And I believe he's got some time to sign it, but in any there's a specified number of days that are allowed to in the gap between when bills pass the assembly and when they go to the governor for decision.
Okay. And what was in the bill? What was it granting?
Yeah. So the final passage, it will grant full practice for certified nurse midwives after completing 1,000 hours of practice under a consultation agreement with a certified nurse midwife or with a physician. And then we also added language that is consistent in the newly passed CM bill, because we also were successful in passing legislation to license certified midwives this year. And there was language that was in that bill that also currently exists in code for our certified professional midwife colleagues that states that a physician is not liable for any of the care provided by an independent midwife. And so in most cases, except in cases when a midwife is not employed by a physician, that language is quite unnecessary, but in any case, it makes everybody feel real good to have that clause. So we added that clause to give some encouragement to some of the concerns from our physician colleagues. So that's what the bill does. And so for midwives who have been in practice and for midwives who will come from other states to Virginia, if you have been in practice for 1,000 hours, then you could come with attestation for that and be practicing autonomously.
What do you need to prove that?
It requires an attestation from the physician or the CNM who you have been in that consultation agreement with for that first 1,000 hours.
And what number state is Virginia that's allowing CMs?
We are number, we thought we were number 7, but
yeah, that's what I'd heard.
Because Oklahoma passed last year. Okay. So we're number eight for CMs, and we'll be number 29 for full practice authority.
That's great. That's big for Virginia.
Yeah. Big. It's monumental.
Yeah. You've done great work. I've been watching you, you know, cheering your flags on Instagram, and
I'm tired. And I think I've been a little bit naive, isn't the right word. And I don't think I've been quite Pollyanna either, you know, but I feel so strongly that why can't we all just do the right thing? And that's how I try to live. And I speak quite plainly. And so I don't do what I really don't cope well or do well with this setting and process of everyone being kind of duplicitous I don't understand that. My brain doesn't work that way. It's really quite infuriating. And that's how this whole thing works.
So who initiated this?
The bill, we did. So we started actually working on and discussing full practice authority several years ago. So we, in 2017, we were working on updating and changing our licensure and were advancing a full practice bill at that time. And what that bill did is we're in Virginia, we're licensed as nurse practitioners. And so all of our language for CNMs is within the NP section of code, right? So when you're looking at changing any bills, you got to start with what code section are you in the first place? And then what are we going to change? And so we had asked, we were trying for independent practice then, and the time wasn't right. And so what we ended up compromising with at that time, which just means what you can pass without too much opposition from medical society. I mean, truly, in most states, the greatest opposition is going to be from the local AMA, American Medical Association. I mean, they have a national campaign against stopping creep, as they see it, into medicine, which I find completely unironic because, you know, midwives don't practice medicine. We practice midwifery. And so
is it called?
Their campaign is all about stopping creep, the creep. So the infringement and enclosure and the movement of non-physicians into physician territory. It's all over their website. You should look it up on their advocacy things. It's really gross. And I don't mind saying that in a public forum.
Mm-hmm. So, I'll look at that.
There's a lot of things that we have worked with MSV in particular with the Association of Virginia and have worked together to advance legislation related to COVID and related to telehealth and reimbursements and things like that. So there's a lot of things that we do quite well together. This isn't one of them. It just isn't. So in 2017, what we changed was at that time we were practicing in collaboration and the way that the state of Virginia defines collaborative practice or a collaboration agreement is explicitly says under the direction of a patient care team physician, which is the language that most often is promulgated and promoted by AMA, because it leaves the physician as the head of the team, right? And in the concept of team-based care, as it's defined by ACNM and by ACOG, which is also endorsed by AAP and the AAPA and the American Association of Nurse Practitioners and like 17 other practitioner organizations. It's the lead of the team shifts based on the needs or the preferences of the client or people at the center of care, right? And so it's just a different, it's a different definition of team-based care in terms of just who's leading the team. And so we don't use collaboration at, or collaboration agreement in our law or in our code sections, because in Virginia, that means under the direction of a team-based physician. And so we changed it to consultation. And so our consultation agreement had to just say, we had to have a consultation agreement with a physician, and it would say when the physician was available for, or that a physician would be available for routine or urgent consultation. And we were able to separate out our prescriptive authority that if we only prescribed schedule six, which would be like birth control pills and things that have absolutely no addictive potential, we didn't have to have anything written. Although in practice and by the regulations, everything needs to be written. If we were going to prescribe our full to our full scope, then we would also need to include our prescriptive authority things within our consultation agreement. And so we've been bopping along with that for about 4 years, which is it. And even that transition didn't change a lot of where midwives practice, where CNMs practice in Virginia, because the majority of us are employed by physician groups or employed by institutions, either within physician groups, or now there are a few practices that are midwifery practices within the division, you know, so within either the Department of OBGYN or within the Women and Children's Division, like ours. So that's the employment landscape for the majority of CNMs. But you know, CNMs also care for people in birth center and in home birth, and even for when we don't attend births, we care for people in private practices and sometimes in our own private practice. And we can provide telehealth, and we can provide, you know, contraceptive care and reproductive care that independent or separate from our labor and birth care. And so those are activities that can very reasonably occur in a community-based setting or in a telehealth-based setting, right? So for those midwives and for institutional-based midwives as well, the challenge has been finding physicians. If you are not in a practice where they are also employed, finding physicians who are willing or able to sign the consultation agreements. So in some communities, Charlottesville is a great example. There are a couple, you know, there's university-based practices and school-based practices. None of those physicians routinely consult and collaborate with midwives, both within the system, the systems outside of those employment models, right? But they're not allowed to sign a consultation agreement. They're restricted from being able to do that. So there are no clinicians in that immediate area. So there's midwives Southwest Virginia is another really great example. There's I know of at least four midwives out there who use the same physician. They cover areas from Roanoke to Bristol, you know, which is a 3-hour radius, using the same one physician. And that's not the only physician that's in that area, right? There's several hospitals. There are several private practices. And other midwives have shared stories of maybe they have a relationship with a specific clinician in one particular practice, but if it's a privately owned practice and the rest of the physicians aren't interested in engaging in that agreement, then they may not be able to work that. And so it's not a problem of midwives having consultation relationships with physicians. Right? That's not, in most places, that's not generally the issue. For one, because midwives are really great at building their networks, right? For another, it's part of our standards of care to do so. So in order to have a practice, we must have a clinician establish relationships of some kind with clinicians of all kinds, and have the capacity to be able to refer and consult and collaborate as needed. It's not an option. So we're bound by that from a you know, standard of care perspective, but we're also bound by that morally and ethically and based on our philosophy. That's part of what we do and who we are. We don't provide care in a vacuum, and it's not possible for us to provide care in a vacuum, and it's not safe or practical or any of those things to provide care isolated in a vacuum in Southwest Virginia or anywhere else. You know, so the problem is not in the ability to take people, but it's in the capacity of, and the power lies with the physician. The physicians then maintain the ultimate authority to determine whether and where a midwife can serve and how. So then the other issue becomes, you know, midwives that are employed in physician practices, depending on the format of the practice and the reason for why midwives were put in that practice in the first place. You know, this isn't unique to Virginia. It's that question of are midwives even in their current practices being utilized to their full scope and to their full capacity, you know, or are they, I don't like the term physician extender because it's demeaning for one. And I think it also doesn't really capture, the meaning of the problem, right? Because I don't think it communicates really what's happening. We're really just not being utilized to, and not being appreciated, not being valued, and not being utilized to what we can actually do. And in some cases are actually limited and restricted because of micromanaging and structural oversight and lack of attribution or lack of you know, adequate hospital privileging and credentialing, which ultimately goes back to licensure autonomy, muddies a lot of what we do and how we do it. You know, I kind of went on a couple of little different tangents there, but what this bill does is it allows us to practice without having to have a written agreement for consultation to say so that we can be licensed. It most definitely does not mean that we won't consult or collaborate, which is being promoted by some individuals as what ultimately this bill means. And in fact, we maintained language within the bill that explicitly states, it's what it says is that we will be licensed to practice in accordance with the ACNM standards of care, standards of practice, and regulations promulgated by our joint boards of nursing and medicine, because that's how we're regulated in Virginia. And then it says that we will, that we shall refer, consult, collaborate, and refer based on the needs of the patient. And so that added language was explicit in there as well. Yeah.
And that was pushed back, as I saw from this process. Like it was pushed against, like that wasn't good enough.
Yeah, it wasn't good enough, but because they latched onto this concept of independent, I still don't understand why, because physicians know what it means to practice independently. Usually it means in your own practice, or not, you think about independent practices as not being owned by institutions or not being conglomerates, you know, or whatever. It's your own standalone practice. But that doesn't mean they practice in isolation.
Right.
So I'm not sure why for midwives and for nurse practitioners and for other advanced practice professionals that independent becomes this dirty word and it means that I could own my own practice. I could go set up shop somewhere, anywhere I wanted to, where the needs of the community were present. And I would still communicate and consult and refer. One, because I'm a midwife and that's how we practice, but also because that's ethical, our physician colleagues are bound to those same ethical principles. You know, we use an example quite a bit of, like, if for an OBGYN, if they're taking care of a client who has a cardiac issue in pregnancy and needs to be sent to a cardiologist, they don't have a relationship, a written agreement with a cardiologist that says, if my patient needs to see a cardiologist, I'm going to send them to you. or the an agreement from the cardiologist that says, if you need me, you may consult me. Because that really is what the agreement says. It says, if we need them, they will be available to us. So it doesn't, even the way the original agreement and the original law is written, in my opinion, actually says nothing to what the midwife does. It really is all about saying that the physician will consult with us. And that's something quite different and should be concerning for anyone who's in non-physician practice, because again, it really points to that power dynamic.
Yeah.
That is unnecessary, because we do have collaborative relationships and we all affirm that those relationships are critical, and we've got to figure out how to do those better within midwife practices that serve in hospitals, but especially within midwife practices that serve in communities, because that is how we improve the safety and already stellar outcomes of midwife and CNM attended birth, regardless of where it occurs. So there was pushback specifically to the concept of independent, that we and specific examples and verbiage used that we were just going to go practice by ourselves and be an island unto ourselves, and that would be unsafe. There were concerns raised about the competency of and skill of a midwife when we graduate. Mm-hmm. And I think that has to do with a misunderstanding and a fundamental difference in the way that midwifery education specifically validates how we have professionals that are able to become board certified, right? So all of our education and training is competency based. And so it's not hours, and it's not, there's a specific minimum number of procedures or visit types or births that must be attended. But if you don't display competence by those minimums, you do more.
Yep.
So that's the floor, not the ceiling. And so that's a little bit of a foreign concept in physician care, and even in other advanced practice, clinical education, where it might be hours based or specific visit number based, so it's very much not checkbox. And that's very different and very unique and very critical also to emphasize, that we've been working to emphasize, is that we, competency is established at the national level, which is also endorsed internationally, right? Because all of our competencies and standards meet the International Confederation of Midwife standards. And so what we said was quite audacious for some members of the General Assembly to suggest that Virginia had better understanding of or better capacity to be able to judge or determine competency of a midwife above our national organizations and even the ICM.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. True. So I do have a question. Why do you have a thoughts on why there was, because the votes were so different from the House to the Senate? Why?
Apparently that's normal. So some of that is, it's just the way, and federally, I think we see some of this too, it's just the way of the, and having different chambers and different functions of how they serve the people. I think they view their role a little bit differently. And so it's just the way it goes, I suppose. And some of it has to do with the makeup a little bit of the representatives in both houses. There are some medical professionals in the Senate. And so that changes and influences some of the conversation.
Yeah. And we had medical representatives in the House. Correct.
Yes. Specifically, we have we have a nurse practitioner.
Yes.
Adams has been our chief patron and is just a wonderful human being and has been a great champion. And there's some other clinicians as well in both settings, but Dawn Adams has really been our champion and speaks from a place of authority and experience and expertise, being a nurse practitioner with independent practice in Virginia, who has also been part of the General Assembly for a while and has been a practitioner in Virginia for even longer. So that was powerful. And
I think I told you she was my policy teacher for my doctor. Yeah. So it's kind of neat. Okay. I know we're going to get into your story. We're doing this backwards, but walk me through, like, for every midwife listening, because this is a lesson in government.
Yeah.
Tell it to us. Like we're in second grade. How does this happen?
It very much is like, if you remember Schoolhouse Rock, and if you don't, go YouTube it for people that are, you know, not over the age of 30. It very much is like the Schoolhouse Rock song, you know? So, and some of this is going to vary a little bit by, of course, a little bit by the rules in each state and how it goes. So, you introduce a bill. So you as a organization or as a private citizen can talk with either your representative, if it pertains to a particular issue in your community, or to just a champion, someone who can champion your issue. And so in the case of midwifery legislation, it's great if you have a nurse practitioner or a midwife or someone who works with midwives in the legislature. There are midwife and reproductive care and women's health care champions there, and people who are interested in reducing and eliminating racial disparities and reducing maternal mortality and infant mortality for Black and Brown and Indigenous people. So find them. So you talk with them about your issue and you write a bill. Well, you look at the existing code, figure out which things need to be edited or amended. And then that information goes to the people within the government that write the bills, right? So there's a lawyer and everybody, and what they're doing is making sure that anything you're putting in the bill isn't conflicting with other code sections. So your bill gets filed and it starts in its house of origin. So in our case, for the CNM bill, we only submitted in the house for the CM bill, for the certified midwife bill, we submitted both in the House and in the Senate. So we had two patrons that carried in both chambers. We didn't have that connection to be able to carry the CNM bill in the Senate also. So if you do have people and advocates in both sides, submit two. And so they just look the exact same. They just get two file numbers. And so then what happens is the bill gets assigned by the leadership within the House to a committee. And usually it's going to go to whichever. And so in this case, in Virginia, it went to the Health, Welfare and Institutions Committee. And then within each committee, there's subcommittees. So it was sent to the Health Professions Subcommittee. So that's the first place you got to go. You got to talk with and advocate for all of the people who sit on the Health Professions Subcommittee. But while you're doing that, you also need to think about talking with all the people on the Health and Wellness, on the main committee. And maybe even also be talking with people in the full if you're anticipating it to get that far. Bills frequently die in committee or in subcommittee. So we advanced out of the subcommittee. Oh, I think it wasn't unanimous out of that committee. Maybe it was. Now I can't remember because there've been so many votes on it. In any case,
how were you talking to these people in the committee? Was it your organization?
Great, perfect. Okay. Our organization. So Virginia ACNM has a lobbyist. We employ a lobbyist who helps coordinate and identify, and she's just, she's fantastic. And we've been really fortunate of working with a lot of really great lobbyists. And so she knows the legislators. She knows their voting records. She knows their personalities. She knows their legislative aides. So what we're what we're asking members to do when we know we're going before the subcommittee is we're asking members to send an email or pick up the phone and call their offices or ask for a meeting. Okay. And in the time of COVID, you're meeting either by phone or by Zoom or just leaving a voicemail. And that's true even in regular session. You might be meeting on the phone, you might be meeting in person, or you might just be leaving a voicemail. And meeting with the legislative aide is the same thing pretty much as meeting with the representative themselves. So if you can get a meeting with the rep, great. If you only get a meeting with their LA, perfect. That's still great. And so you just tell them who you are and what you want them to vote for and what the issues are. If you're part of the, you know, in our case, our legislative team, myself and our awesome legislative chair, Nicole Wardlaw, we had a lot of meetings with our lobbyists, with the patrons, with the representatives or with their legislative aides, really just talking about the bill and the need and the challenges, and really, because you've got to demonstrate that there is a problem with current law. Because if there's no problem with current law, then there's no reason to change it. And we talked, and we had meetings months ago, months before the bill was even introduced, with our colleagues with the OBGYN Society and with our colleagues at the Medical Society as well. We had extensive meetings. We also met with leadership within the Department of Health Professions about that we were interested in and hearing concerns that people might have and hearing so that we could incorporate those things into the bill from the beginning to have broad support. And all of that work may or may not translate into broad support from those individuals or those organizations as you're moving forward. And so that's, and then when you get to the committee, so your bill has a hearing then. So we started with our hearing and subcommittee, and we had people that signed up to testify on behalf of the bill, and the opposition had people sign up to testify for opposition. And in a regular, there's different in your, when you're in person or when you're on Zoom, and the chair of the committee decides how long everyone has to speak. And so we were quite limited because of the virtual session and some other things just going on this year, that we were all given either 1 or 2 minutes to speak, sometimes individually, sometimes as a total side. Mm. So we worked on elevator speeches, and we worked on from a strategy perspective, as we had people sign up to come and speak, asking each person to focus on a different aspect of why this was necessary for Virginia, and why midwives were qualified and competent to practice independently, which again just means to the full extent of our education and training and certification, and why we're able to do that from the moment that we're licensed, and it's because we're already board certified, you know, so then they vote right there. And it's a majority rule. And if you have the majority, then you move up to the committee and you wait another week to be put on the committee schedule. So it's like every couple of days or every week, we were like doing this again, and early mornings and strategy calls the night before and emails and texts, of course, back and forth. So it's been really, really exciting and really, really fatiguing. Mm-hmm. And then the same process. So each committee, each new time to every time we went up to the next level, then you've got a new round, the same round of senators or house members to re-talk with, new people that haven't heard the information before. But now we also have a new set of issues, right? Because now we've heard what anyone who is opposed, what's explicitly they're opposed to. So now the arguments or discussions for have to change or augment or be heavily inclusive of what were they saying, and knowing that they are also then going to change their argument because we were successful. So now they have to change the argument again to try to kill the bill. And so we circled back to, and we also, you have a chance during the hearings to hear from the representative as well and hear their concerns and their questions. So then that gives us new information again to take back to those speakers and specifically, but also then to apply and share with other members. And so then we moved on to the House full committee, and we passed there, and we're advanced to the full House. Once it gets to the House, it undergoes a process of reading. And so they can either waive the reading or just the reading. And so, I think we must've come out of the health and wellness. No, the CM bill, the certified midwife bill passed unopposed essentially through the whole thing. And so that mm-hmm. bill really didn't get a lot of debate after you moved out of committee, because there was no opposition to it. And so what they do is they batch all the bills that came out of committee unopposed and just block vote them through. Mm-hmm. If there were bills that had any nay votes, those can be discussed or amended on the floor. And so that's another important thing. At every point it's debated in the subcommittee and then in the full committee and then on the floor of whichever chamber, anyone in opposition can bring amendments to change the bill. And so there were some amendments that were discussed in subcommittee that were recommended and offered in the full committee and were rejected. And then there were no amendments attempted to be added in the House. And so then each day that the House is in session or that the Assembly is in session, then the bill goes through a reading, which just means that it's presented. And so that gives a chance if someone wants to amend it or have questions or present substitute, then they can do that at those times. And it goes through that process three times, which means that you have three chances to change the bill before it gets voted on. Mm-hmm. Before the final vote. So it passed. And then in Virginia, or well, I guess in most places too, when you get to midpoint in a session, there's a something called crossover where all the bills that passed the House and all the bills that passed the Senate now flip chambers and have to go through the same process again in the other side. So we got over to the Senate. We're assigned to the Senate Committee for Health and Education. And Louise Lucas is the chair of that committee and she's a wonderful advocate and a wonderful legislator. And we anticipated that we might get dropped and referred to the subcommittee for health professions, and we were not. We stayed in the Senate, the full committee, and there was, again, an attempt at a similar amendment to what was presented in the House. That was rejected. And we passed the Senate Education and Health Committee on a pretty decent margin. I mean, I think it was 14-9. I mean, there was a 5 or 5-7 vote spread, if I remember right, in favor of the bill. And that moved us to the floor of the Senate. And it went through its first reading without any discussion and went through its second reading without any discussion. And the morning of its third reading, Senator Donovan from Henrico introduced a substitute bill. And all the way through this process, the bill came, because the bill initially asked for just full practice authority outright. So there wasn't a transition of practice. There was nothing else on it. It was just that. And so we had moved the bill all the way through on a, you know, without any additional language. And so there was a substitute bill presented that would add and would allow independent practice if you did not attend births immediately. And if you did attend births, it would have required 25 additional births under a consultation agreement. And the spirit of that amendment was, of that piece of the amendment, was from what we understand from previous conversations and discussions, was to account for, to ensure that there was support for new graduates or for those who have. But it would allow certified nurse midwives to be able to enter those consultation agreements for the first time. And then there was some additional language of a request for delayed enactment. And when they put delayed enactment, what it means is it won't be passed until after the next session, because that allows the bill has to be reconsidered in the next session. And means that other things can be added or changed or that the bill could be pulled at that point. And they requested that a study be done specifically so that the Department of Health Professions could study the safety of birth. And some of the rhetoric was really quite concerning and quite shocking, because there were some comments made that that Virginia has an infant mortality crisis, and we need to ensure that allowing independent CNMs won't worsen the infant mortality crisis. And so that the amendment was accepted. And so now what happens is the Senate version looks different from the House version. So then the bill went back to the House, and the House has to either say, yes, we adopt that one, let's advance that one, or say, nope, we don't like it. And they request a conference. And so then when that happens, three delegates, including the chief patron and three senators, were voted to be representatives. And those six officials discussed and determined either which bill would be advanced or if there was a new. And that's where we were able to discuss and introduce the compromise language for 1,000 hours. And we did that because no other law, and certainly nowhere in Virginia code and nowhere else in the country, is our procedures or anything related that specifically to scope of practice included in code. And so that was a really, really concerning language that was added. And the intention was that because it was, you know, a reasonable number of births and it's just irrelevant. It's just not, you don't put procedures like that, because again, what it's saying is that the 60 births that we minimally attend in labor and the 35 that we minimally attend as primary midwife in accordance with our certification board with the ACME standards through our education programs as the minimum threshold for competency attainment. It means that that's not good enough. Mm-hmm. That in order to be competent, you really have to do 25 more. And if it's 25 more this year, why not 50? Why not 100? Why not 500? You know, and so we were really pleased that language was removed. And then the compromise also removed the delayed enactment. So if when it signed, when the governor signs this bill, then it will be enacted on July 1 this year. So we're really excited about that. And there's some other studies there was a study that was added to the certified midwife bill when it will be signed. It will have a study that we'll look at in Virginia, not the validity of midwifery licensure or certification, but the regulations of midwifery broadly in Virginia to look at how can we best regulate and where are midwives best represented? Because we have some midwives that are represented by the joint boards. We have some midwives that are represented by the Board of Medicine. And so it'll be a conversation and a task force with midwives. So we're pretty excited about that. So now the compromise bill then had to go back to both chambers, and it was unopposed in the House. And then yesterday, after two times of voting, successfully passed both times, and it will now go to the governor. And there's a little bit of time. It's none of that happens immediately. And I don't know if the time amount is different in each state, but anyway, he's got a certain amount of time to have the bills before they have to be signed.
That is super intense. And I'm sitting here thinking, how was she doing all of that and working? Like, how did you squeeze all that in?
I don't know. My partners probably, I love my partners, in practice and my partners and my kids and my partner and my kids in real life, you know? So, it was happening on days off and in between patients before. And I remember at one point I had someone cover my office hours a little bit. We have a fellow who we've been onboarding with our practice and she's been in a fellowship training. And so I happened to be working with her two of the days that we had to testify. So that was really exciting. And one, I think when we had moved out of the Senate, that was a tough hearing. I was pacing and, you know, and I'm very emotive and I was emoting and then we voted and I like squealed and screamed and, you know, of course people ran out of the rooms and were like, oh my God, what's wrong? I was like, oh, sorry. That was just me. Patients were like, is everything okay? I'm like, yes, everything's okay. Our midwife's just having a moment back there. So,
well, I'm sure they were glad to support you.
Yeah.
With your time needed to focus on that.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know how I do what I do. I feel like I've always been able to juggle lots and do lots at one time. I like that. I am experiencing new seasons of maybe I'm doing a little too much. Of course I feel like that. And right as I really start to feel like that, whatever I was working on moves off my plate because I finished it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not very good at learning my lesson of maybe I shouldn't do so much, but I don't know. I'm working on it. I'm a work in progress.
So, I mean, I guess you should briefly tell us why you became a midwife in the first place.
So I think the story is pretty fun too. So I don't, I don't know why initially. I don't know the why, the calling in the first place. I do really feel like it's a calling, and I have a heart for service and for serving the community. Where I used to live, there was a nursing home. And I suppose a rehab hospital as well, but it was a nursing home literally right behind my backyard. And I would bake cookies and holiday cards and would just walk over with them, you know, and sit with the people and the people who were living there. And so that was always part of my serving my community and meeting people's needs was always a big part of my growing up. And my family works in healthcare and I remember, you know, I mean, I was always drawn towards nursing and caring sort of fields and thought I would, and actually at some point determined I would be an OBGYN. Never saw anything born, animals, nothing. Mm-mm. Didn't know what a midwife was, had no connection to midwifery, in any fashion. And thought I would be an OBGYN. And then in high school, I had, when I was a junior, I was doing a health profession. It wasn't health professions. It was just a, how to be a professional course, you know, and we had to do job shadowing. And so I was able to go and job shadow with some labor and delivery nurses at one of the hospitals in the community where my parents worked. And my intention was to see what the OBs did, right? And just to be immersed in obstetrics, because that's what they do, you know, they take care of babies. And it was really wonderful. And I learned so much and I will never forget the first birth. This woman was so amazing. And I'm really honored that I was invited and allowed to be present. And her physician came in. She had been pushing, I guess, I don't remember how long, but I remember her physician came in, delightful fellow. They had some banter back and forth. He was very kind. She was very, you know, and it was like, seemed very great. And then he just said, okay, I'll be back later and keep it up and turned around and walked out of the room. And I thought, where's he going? And then we continued working. And then the baby was here. And then I don't remember him coming back in for birth. I remember the birth. So obviously somebody came back in and was there, but I do. I remember him coming in. I remember having some fun, haha, nice moments. And then he left again. And so that struck me very much of, I don't think I can do that. Because I recognized that in that moment, anyway, what I understood was there was a connection that I would be missing. Mm-hmm. Or that I wanted. And that's interesting to me being on this side of it, that I would read so much of that into that moment. And I think there's a lot that I gained out of that moment. And I know there's a lot that I missed out of that interaction too, right? Like, of course, that's not the whole essence of their relationship, but in any case, so I thought, well, gosh. And so I went home and I'm like, well, I don't think I can be an OBGYN. I think I need to be a nurse. I think I need to be a labor and delivery nurse instead. And my mom, in her wisdom, my sister and I decided long ago that she, and long before this moment, that she had been with us long enough and had proven herself that she wasn't a step. She was our smom. So my smom,
that's sweet.
She says in her infinite wisdom, said, you don't want to be a nurse. You need to be the person giving the orders.
She must have known you well.
She knew me well. At my 16-year-old self, I was 16 at the time. And said, "You should be a midwife." And I never asked her why she knew midwives. And I think I still haven't to this day. And I think it probably was because there were midwives at the time within the health system, right? And so I thought, midwife. Wow. So I went, you know, Google was around then. And so I looked on the internet and this is really stupid. Somewhere I found this pamphlet, no idea where it came from, that had information about PAs and nurse midwives and nurse practitioners. And it had a map of where they were licensed to practice and had information about things like, you know, education and titles and salaries and was like a comparison chart or whatever. And I hung it on my wall.
Wow.
I have it on my wall. And I was like, I'm going to be a midwife. And so I thought, well, gosh, I'll have to go to nursing school. And I'll have to. And so I was 17 and I made the decision to do that, of course, but in my 17-year-old brain and in my infinite wisdom at the time, I hadn't connected the dots that meant I would need to go to nursing school. And it hadn't even occurred to me that I might have to work as a nurse first before I could go be a midwife. And none of that was in my brains when I played volleyball at the time, and I was recruited to come to Randolph-Macon Women's College to play volleyball. And so I did that, and this was the exact right place I was supposed to be. And so I thought, okay, well, I guess I'll go be a biology major or a chemistry major, and then I'll figure out, and then I'll go to nursing school, and then I'll be a midwife. Right? Sure. And after I had applied and was accepted and was planning to come here, I got my course catalog, I was flipping through it. And lo and behold, we had a bridge program, or it was a 3-2 is what the model is called, where you do 3 years at your main institution and 2 years within another institution, and you get two degrees at the end of it. And we had a program with Johns Hopkins that was a nursing program. So I could do my degree. I could do a combined degree from Randolph and Hopkins. And then Hopkins I forget who their affiliation was for midwifery at the time, it was through Hopkins. So I thought, well, oh, perfect. I can go to the school that I need to go in that I was called to, and then I can go do the thing that I was called to do. Still not really having anything beyond that. Okay. I was very Pollyanna about this. Like, it's just going to work out. And then in my first semester, when I was meeting with my advisor, learned, oh, we have another program with Vanderbilt. And the Hopkins program was dual enrolled for a bachelor. So I would have two bachelors. This was dual enrolled for their master's, because Vanderbilt doesn't do bachelors. They do a bridge to master's. And Vanderbilt had the midwifery program. So I was able to bridge to my master's in 5 years. So I did 3 years at Randolph. Had to do all the requirements for my degree plus the prereqs for Vanderbilt. And then it wasn't guaranteed that I would, when I applied, that you would get in, right? And so I applied to the program and was accepted, and did the in that first year and a half. It was an accelerated nurse equivalency program that they do, and then went straight into the midwifery program. So it was just like, of course I'm going to do that. And I did. And here I am 10 years later.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to practice as a nurse.
No, yeah. No. And and there's more of me, there's more like me that are following this model. I mean, there were a lot in 2009 when I finished, but not a lot. I mean, and there's still quite a lot of places and quite a lot of midwives and quite a lot of enclaves that really feel strongly that you can't be a midwife unless you've been a nurse first. And, yeah. and I can empathize with that. I don't understand it, but I can empathize and acknowledge that belief. And now there's so many more programs that have the opportunity for people to come straight in. Now, in most cases, you still have to have a bachelor's of science in nursing, you know, and many people will work as a nurse while they're going through school, you know, and then now we have, you know, programs and as more states license certified midwives, we'll have more pathways for that. So you can bypass nursing. And I think that's important to have. I think I have such deep respect for my nurse colleagues and for my partners who were nurses first, you know, because they bring such different, I mean, it's just different experience that you bring with it. You know, I mean, I think we all come with different critical experience and life skills and ways of viewing the world that we bring really importantly to midwifery. And I just reject that concept that you have to have been a nurse first, because what we do is not nursing.
Yeah.
You know, it's midwifery and it's its own thing. And I'm going to get on other tangents
I mean, I've interviewed those midwives and they've said, I wanted to be a midwife. I didn't want to be a nurse.
Yep.
And yeah. I don't think I had to have been. I'm like, I get it. And just meeting all these midwives have really opened my eyes to that perspective as well. So it's been really good.
Mm.
So did you practice? Is this your first job that you're still at?
No. So I interned with this practice. It was a private practice initially in 05 and 06. And I interned with the practice. I was looking for an internship because I wanted to study abroad and in a nursing program in Denmark. And because I wasn't a nursing student, technically or actually, it was a nursing program for nursing students. So I had to do something to get accepted and be able to go. So I was trying to get in with this practice because there was the only midwives at the time, and they weren't taking me. And then I was coaching. I coached a club volleyball team that year, and one of my players, her mother was one of the midwives. So I got to go and shadow with her.
Yeah.
And worked with her both of my spring semesters. When I was in the off season, I was interning with her in the hospital and in the office. And so the plan was for me to always do my integration here, and that worked out. And I came back and did integration here, and the practice had been acquired by the hospital that year. By the time I came back for integration, it was a midwife only practice that had been acquired by the hospital. And so at the end of integration, it wasn't the right time for the practice or really for myself to work here. And so that didn't work out. So I went back to Nashville and joined my rest of my colleagues who were looking for jobs, which was just a frustrating and hard season. And I was hired and found a really phenomenal practice in Pennsylvania. It was a physician practice, and I was their first midwife. It was their second. They had had another midwife who had been with them for about 8 months, and had to leave. And so I was their, you know, their second midwife, I suppose. But as my first job, and it was so rad, and I'm so thankful for their mentorship. And I learned a lot about what I was looking for in a practice. And I learned a lot about what I felt like I was not looking for in a practice. And we had, after 3 years, we had different visions of where to go, where we should take the practice next, the practice was having some growing pains and making some big transitions, and we had different visions on what my contribution could be and what midwifery could be in the community. Mm-hmm. And it was a really, I was so sad to leave. It was a really beautiful community and a really wonderful practice of clinicians. And I have such deep respect and deep thanks for what they taught me and what the nurses there taught me and what the community, what I learned from the community. And so I at the time had gotten a call from my friend who was here and said, "Hey, we're hiring again. Do you want to come?" And it was just, again, it was just perfect timing.
Yeah.
And so I came down and I had a lot of, it was really distressing because my job wasn't bad. I loved my job. You know, we just were having some philosophical differences and surely those things work out. And so I just put it to my husband and I said, "Listen, this is what's being offered. We know the area. This is what we have here. We know the area. And I had some pretty cool opportunities in both places." And I said, "What do you want to do?" You know, he had been not following me around, but following me around for, you know, 5 years, you know, because everywhere we were going and moving after we got married was everything for our whole relationship was all dependent on where I was in my trajectory, you know, because we were together since high school. So he followed me and we moved where I needed to move. And so I said, "Listen, you decide, because we'll make it work and do beautiful things wherever we go." And our eldest had been born at the time. She had been born that fall. You know, and then a couple months later, it was like, "Hey, you want to come?" Or she was one already. She had just turned one. Mm-hmm. When all of this was happening. So we moved here in 2013 and have been here since and have really been able to participate and support and contribute to a lot of really cool change in the community and now really cool change in the state.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And Lynchburg, as we said offline, is a beautiful community, you know, so much really history is. And mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have just one last question. What have your physician colleagues thought of all your advocacy for this change in midwifery?
I don't know. So our practice, so we're a midwife only practice. And so our, I mean, you know, I have physician colleagues that work within the department. And then of course we have a group of consultants who we work very closely with. And I, you know, remember talking with one of our consultants, and she, I said, hey, so this is what this bill is about, and this is what we're doing. And I would love for you to call to write some letters and write some supports. She said, you know, I'm not into that advocacy thing. Call so-and-so, call Dr. So-and-so. It's like, oh, you suck. You know, we had a fun moment about it. And so and then we've had some, you know, I have had talked with a couple of them who have been so supportive and have written letters of support. And you know, personally, it's been either no discussion or just, I think to some extent, some of it may be a little bit of like, oh, what's Katie doing again? You know, I think I have a little bit of a reputation in my community, my organization of like, oh God, what's she asking for now? So I think a little bit of it might be received that way. A little bit of it is just, I mean, they don't know how to, I don't know that many of them know how to take it. And several, the ones who did, who we talked with and had a lot of really great conversation about what does this bill mean and why are we looking to do this and how will this change our relationship? And practice, they understood the merits of the bill and were generally supportive to the care that we provide and the care that we provide together, right? And the work that we do together in the community, but weren't willing to be public in their support because of their relationships and role within their professional organization. Mm-hmm. And so that's been hard. That's been hard. I respect it, but it's been hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess it just dawned on me too, that you said it was already a midwifery run practice.
Yeah. Well, it's hospital owned, but midwifery run. Yeah. Right, and we've had really great, you know, and we've had really great support from the organization, you know, so my organization is very supportive of advanced practice providers broadly, you know, so we've had a lot of conversation within the advanced practice provider structure, and within even the administration, you know, physician administration, et cetera, you know, has been very supportive of the changes and of our advocacy work. And that's been really, really, really wonderful too, you know, because I haven't felt it hasn't been hard for me professionally to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know what I would feel like, or I don't know what it would mean to me differently. And I don't have that experience that others may have I have the experience of feeling like I wasn't being encouraged or not being encouraged or outright being told to stop. I have had those experiences in advocacy and even in my interest in quality improvement work. And, you know, I ruffle feathers and I upset people and I say wrong things and sometimes a whole lot, you know, I'm extra. I'm pretty extra,
but you keep going. Like,
but such, I keep going. Yeah.
Such, it's so, you're brave. Yeah. You're brave.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm hard-headed.
What? Well, you know what? I don't know too many midwives that aren't.
Same thing. Yeah, maybe those are the same thing.
I think they go hand in hand. Yeah. So you've been a midwife for a while. What would be your advice to a new midwife?
I don't settle. You know, I tell people this when we're thinking, you know, that those first couple of months while you're waiting for a job and even before you're waiting for a job are scary. And, you know, depending on your economic needs, you know, I came from a place of privilege that we were able to live with my parents while I was waiting for a job. And they supported my husband and I, and he lived with them when we had to get out of when we had to leave our apartment when we were in the middle of job changes, because we weren't going to be there for another year, you know? So I came from that place. of that if you don't, if you are able to be picky and find a place that is, that meets your philosophical goals and meets the needs that you have at the time, wait and find that place. And if you can't find a place where you can learn some skills and contribute to the community and contribute to your clients that you're serving above all, and then move on when the right time, when the right time is, you know, and you don't have to stay. Our practice places don't have to be forever. And yeah. I think surround yourself with people in community that, that you can pour into and that can pour into you. You know, how am I able to do all of the things that I'm doing, and how am I able to keep going when I don't know how to say no? It's because I have people that pour into me when I am pouring out.
I love that. That's beautiful advice.
Thank you.
I have people pouring into me when I'm pouring out.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Katie. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, I'm so really so thrilled to have been able to be here with you. Thank you.
Yeah, me too. It was a long time coming, I think.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, podcast fans, that's a wrap on another episode of Journey to Midwifery. If you liked this podcast, you can follow me at Journey to Midwifery Podcast on Instagram. You can also email me at journeytomidwiferypodcast@gmail.com. If you liked Katie's story, you can follow the Virginia ACNM page on Instagram. She shares all kinds of informative information, advocacy, and it's a great page to follow. So remember to send me suggestions of who you want on the podcast. And if you yourself would like to be on, please reach out to me. I'm always looking for volunteers. Remember, it's just me, the host, the editor, the PR person. So I appreciate all community involvement. Until next time.